Welcome to another instalment of the Evolution Exchange podcast. Today, I'm joined by Daniel Bratmark, Dimitrios Sergio, and Andrew Wimberg to discuss building a security culture for success. Before we get into the topic in a bit more detail, we'll work our way around the room with some introductions. So, Daniel, would you like to kick us off?
Yes, I'm happy to. I'm Daniel. I work at Closer, which is an IT provider. And my role is that I am head of security and compliance. I have worked with security for 20 years. And I've been in different roles. I've been a CISO and I've been a consultant manager, etc. I've done this a while and I think it's a really interesting topic. So I'm happy to be here.
Amazing. Thank you. And Dimitrios.
Hi, my name is Dimitrios. Usually people call me Dimi because it's a very lengthy Greek name that nobody can pronounce correctly. I have been in information security for give or take 25 years. I've passed through pretty much all the relevant roles, going from cybersecurity and being an engineer to being a consultant. And the last 15 years, I have been holding CISO positions or director of information security positions. I currently work for TapTapSend. And given that most of the organizations that I prefer to work with are smaller startup or grow up organizations, I'm very interested in how we build security culture from the start and how we avoid having a huge security department responsible for everything. Thank you for having me. And I'm going to pass it to Andrew.
My name is Andrew Wimberg, and I'm the head of information security at Boyado. I have worked in technologies in various industries, from medical technology to telco to now I'm working in SaaS. So I'm working with basically all aspects of security and security culture at Boyado.
Hi, everyone. This is Chris Bennett here, a Nordics Managing Director here at Evolution. We're committed to doing recruitment in a different way that adds value to both our clients and candidates by providing you with amazing speakers and leading-edge discussions on what's going on in the tech scene at the moment. There are three reasons why you should contact me. If you would like to speak on a future podcast, if you are interested in hiring awesome tech, data, product or gaming freelancers for your business, or if you are looking for an exciting new organization to work with, please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope to hear from you soon. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Amazing, lovely. Well, now that we all know you a bit better, we'll get stuck into the topic at hand. So as usual, we'll make our way around the group, asking your questions and sharing your thoughts about our topic of building a security culture for success. So Daniel, your question is up first, and you ask, how are you able to make sure that you can get buy-in from the whole organization, including management, to move from awareness to a security culture? So tell us a bit more about your question.
Yeah, well, the way I'm thinking, especially about the security culture part is that we do talk a lot about security awareness and the different steps you have to reach, but I feel that just awareness, that is just the first step. And usually you have quite a bit to go from there in order to actually achieve a security culture in the organization, which is, I think all of us here today agree that that's what we need to get to, really, the way things are today. So there are a few thoughts that I have behind that. Why I choose that question and also why I think it is so important. The first one is that it's really important for everyone, management and everyone in the organization, to have an understanding of why we actually have to do this. Where does it come from and what is the reason? And I think quite closely tied to that is what we often talk about, which is what happens if we don't do it. You can talk about whether it's right to scare people into these things, but it is important to have that understanding. What happens if we don't do it? And the other thing I also think is that really sort of small details can have big effects. So it's easy to say that there's mostly we're okay, but as we know, there can be very small actions that can cause big serious or negative effects. So I mean, like one click can be very, very serious, and that can cause big effects. So understanding that I mean, you can't just get the big things right. You have to have a sort of a thorough view of everything and get the details right as well. And the reason why I included management, and so that is very important, is that what management say and do is very important in an organization. It's hard or almost impossible to work with the culture from below and et cetera if management doesn't buy into it, and also if they don't follow it, then it's very hard because people will look to them in the end. So tone from the top is crucial. And I mean, it's almost impossible to get these things done and to build this without that. So that's why we need management buy-in, and we also need them to lead by example, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
And then also about awareness, that unless we actually live awareness, we cannot turn it into culture. So it's one thing about sort of taking the courses and reading the material and so on, but we have to sort of realize that we also has to be how we live and how we work, so on. And maybe sort of going back to what I said about why we do it and what the effects are. I mean, we all have to look to ourselves, to the things we do, and to realize that the things we do, and maybe especially the things we don't do, will have serious effects on the organization and our technology, etc. So yeah, that is sort of the background and my thoughts behind it. So maybe you have some thoughts on it too.
Yeah, I can pick it up. So I'm going to approach it from the perspective of, I have been working a lot with fintech companies or companies that are regulated. And in many, many cases, part of that regulation is pointing to some kind of accreditation standard. So they will say something like, if you comply with ISO 27001, you're quite good. And the very first statement in any kind of ISO that you look at is management commitment, right? So what Daniel was talking about, management is very important because you expect commitment in several different forms. One type of commitment is to give you as the head of security or whatever your title, the resources to do your job. The second type of commitment is that they allow the organization to have the time to learn about the things that you want them to learn. So it's not helpful if you build an amazing program and then you don't give the developers the time to play with the program and have hands-on and understand what is going on. And then obviously the third thing is they need to also walk the walk, which means that you can't have your head of sales opening emails in 45 different devices because it might be a leak. They also need to comply with whatever rules you agree as the organization. So I think it's very important to get the management buy-in, because if any of these three approaches fail, for me, like, the program will fail, because either the people will get the wrong message, or if you don't have the time and money to implement something, it would never happen. Or if the management itself doesn't believe in the mission, then you're just fighting against the windmills like Don Quixote. So I'm definitely with Daniel. I'm always trying to convince the management before we do something, and only if I get them on board, then I will go into the rest of the organization to discuss the how.
To add to the company, in general, and some of them, even the tension points of really being managed on board, in my experience has been that no matter how big or how small the company is, the higher you go in management, the less technical it becomes. And so the communication barriers becomes the largest point of friction, because the security field is often quite technical, especially when it comes to cybersecurity and so on. And so being able to communicate at a level where management can understand and be able to actually pledge their support to the cause, I think that is one of the key points on having upper management support a cultural change.
And that is really important. And another point that I wanted to point out is also that when you go to a much larger company, I mean, I worked in companies from the size of 150,000 to 300. And one of the biggest contrasts is that when you go to a very large company, the culture you immerse yourself in, but in a smaller company, you literally small changes or small actions can actually have pretty large effects in the culture. And so this is a very different weight or ability to actually change or affect the culture in a given company.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, those are good points, definitely. But I also think, because I mean, like you, Andrew, I work both in large organizations and in smaller ones, and there is definitely, I mean, there's difference to culture dynamics and how it works and how it changes. But what one thing that I think, I mean, remains the same is what we talked about, is that management buy-in is necessary. And like you said, Dimitrios, I mean, there's not much point going through with a program or trying to be a change maker, trying to make changes if you don't have that buy-in. So then it's better to have a discussion with management then and try to understand them and their point of view. So and there might be something to what you talked about, the divide there between technical skills, because I mean, as I think we all here share the view that security, that it's not just tech, even if it comes across as very technical sometimes, there's so much more to it than that. And what I've seen through my career is that these roles that we have, it's very important to be the person that can talk both to business people, to management, and to more technical people, because we're always going to be in between there. And if we don't have the skills to communicate with all sort of different levels of the organization, we're never going to succeed. So I think that is it's an important skill for us to be able to talk to everybody, but also to be able to sort of convey the message to everyone, because the more technical person is going to have different challenges and different kind of questions, whereas a business person or sort of a sales marketing person, they're all going to have their questions and challenges to this, but they're going to be quite different. It's our challenge really to keep that together, I think.
Another observation that I have from the years in various industries is that in a larger organization, often these security initiatives are much, in some ways, easier to drive down because upper management is so much further from those that these rules affect. So the unhappiness that may arise or the discord that might create, they're a lot more isolated from it. So, for example, in a 300-person company, the reaction is quite immediate. And these are probably the people you're going to see every day as you walk in the door. So it takes a little bit of a different etiquette and a whole different process to be able to do that. So I think in a larger organization, there's a little bit more freedom to just pass on these so-called draconic laws or draconic initiatives down the line.
Yeah. Exactly. And they're used to that. They're used to receiving that. Those. It's not just security, it's sort of in other areas, processes, etc. So, I mean, maybe in a smaller organization, you'll have more people who challenge it, you know, just because they're not used to just being told in that way. So, yeah, there are different kind of challenges for sure.
I guess that kind of leads us on to Dimitrios, your question next. And you asked, what are some common challenges faced by organizations and how can they overcome these obstacles to foster a culture of security awareness and compliance? So tell us a bit more about your question.
Sure. So I'm mostly working for smaller companies. So at no point I work for any company that had 200,000 people, like Andrew was mentioning. I think my biggest company was maybe 6,000 people. So I was trying to think, since I now moved to a new job about 3 months ago, how would I approach in this company the idea of training and awareness and culture? And
we are very close to what Andrew was describing here, which is a company that has immediate feedback, that if I put something out, people will yell at me immediately. They know me. I'm not an unnamed CISO four countries away and so on. And I started thinking, okay, what are the challenges that I have and how can I approach them? So the first challenge, which I guess every company has, is the diversity of employees. And when I say diversity, I don't mean race or age or sexual preference. I mean the knowledge they require to have based on their position. So I hope we all agree that on average, we would expect an engineer to be more technically capable than a person working on HR. The same way that a person working in finance is more numbers capable compared to myself, for example. That means that by definition, I can't really have one single program or one single approach to how I try to train people, because if I go to HR and I start talking about AWS misconfigurations, nobody will understand anything. No. And if I go to engineers and I say we use firewalls to protect our systems, they're going to yell at me and throw me out of the building. So the first challenge is how do you address diverse groups of people with different kinds of knowledge, and what kind of security program do you need to build to address each one of them in a way that is beneficial to them. The second challenge is, I'm hoping that most organizations will not have that, but there's always some people, groups, or functions that they're resistant to change. They always love how they do things. And typically, when we security people look at things, we might have ideas for improvements or maybe make things a bit more strict. So how do I approach the people that are resistant to change? The third one is something that smaller companies typically face, and that is insufficient resources. So that can be in terms of how much money you have available to build your program, how many people you have helping build the program, and so on. Fourth challenge is complexity of the environment we're in. So most of us are affected definitely by some privacy laws like GDPR, maybe if you're in the US CCPA. From the information security perspective, we might be subject to PCI DSS or ISO or SOC 2. From an EU perspective, NIST, NIS2, DORA, all of these nice things. So each one of them individually makes sense, but you can't build 20 programs, one for each standard. You need to build one program and combine all the standards. So that becomes quite complex on what do I need to train my people on? What do we need to pay attention? How do I make each standard be happy? And so on. So that's another big challenge. And the fourth one is what Daniel addressed basically, which is, okay, you have an idea, you have like a good structure for your program, management buy-in. I'm not going to go into it because we extensively discussed it. And then the fifth challenge is, how do you build program and train people to basically value security a bit more? Because one of the typical things that happens is you have a nice set of trainings and a nice, set of policies. And then people realize that it's very easy, instead of doing the 10 steps that you require, to just go into a random SaaS service, click two buttons, and they get the same service for free, I'm going to say. But basically, you just introduce shadow IT and people can do whatever they want, ignoring your policy. So how do you convince people to stop doing that and instead come on into the fold, follow the process and use the approved systems instead of just going and using whatever? So these are the challenges, and I'm going to pause. I'm going to let the other people see if they agree, disagree, and then maybe I might have some suggestions on what to deal with, how to deal with each one of them.
Yeah, well, I agree with you that those are very relevant challenges, and challenges that we do face all the time. I'm going to start to, because I mean, the last thing you talked about there, really, about how do you make people who resist change and don't want to change, how do you make them change their mind? And that is one of the most difficult questions we do deal with in our jobs, all of us. But what I found recently, or what I sort of seen through the years as well, is that scaring people actually works. And to an extent, but it's it needs to be there as a component, I think, and because But when you, if you look back, maybe sort of like 10 years ago, it was more not as common to have a company close to you or some service that you actually use. It was more often you read in the newspaper about this company in America or this company in Australia or whatever, and there was this sort of big cyber attack and so on. But now I think recently there's more examples of this department store where you are shopping yourself, or the service that you are using, or this company, you know, someone who works for that company that was affected. So I think that seeing what can actually happen to a company of a similar size as yours or a similar business that you are in, etc., will actually make people think. So for example, I mean, we are an IT provider, and there was this big IT provider in Sweden that was affected by cyber attacks not that long ago. And I mean, I use that as examples when I communicate internally, just to say, look, I mean, this company is not that different from us, you know, when this happened. So we work hard every day to avoid these things, but we are not immune. This can happen to us as well. So we have to be aware, and we always have to improve, more or less.
I would like to at a point and for an example where really it's so much everything that Dimitrios was mentioning is so much about culture, not necessarily so much about technology or a process. I mean, when I used to work in telco, upper management basically, in order to really understand what the installers were doing out there, they sent out these checklists. So this exact same process and the exact same checklist sent to the German crew would be executed. They would install one bolt and they would check off one thing. They would install another bolt and they would check off one thing. That was their culture. Yeah. You send it to Asia, the same checklist, and what they will do is they do the whole procedure. That was their whole culture because they want to do it fast. And then they check off the checklist at the end of the day. Then you go to South America with that exact same checklist. I think maybe even Central America, they just don't even care about the checklist. Yeah. You say, oh, what is this? Okay, yeah. This is just extra paper. Mm. So it's so much of it about like you instilling a culture of like, we want to do the job right, because if we don't do the job right, we have to redo all of this. And in the case of security, we may not get a second chance. And that is really about getting the people to understand the culture and drive the organization through culture rather than through more checklists and more technical controls. I mean, no amount of technical control is going to keep anybody from clicking on any random link that appears on their face. They can filter, but no matter what, something is going to get through. But if you train your people and make them aware that don't do that because you're endangering the rest of us who are on the same boat as you, then that's a very different way of looking at it.
Absolutely. I was thinking when you said that, because we talk about death by PowerPoint sometimes, I think you could probably do death by checklist as well.
Yeah.
Because you end up with, there was this colleague in this larger organization I worked for, and for every project there was this checklist that was sent out through Excel. And he was just so frustrated because, well, I filled this checklist in Excel out. This is like the fifth time now this month, and it's the same. I've already answered these questions, so why can't someone just pick it up for me? So it's about, you know, to streamline that, to make sure that if people have actually answered something once, to keep that information and don't just keep asking about it again, because the fifth time someone has answered the same question, they're not going to be as thrilled about it and as thorough maybe as the first time. So be smart about it, I guess.
Nice. Any other follow-up comments or questions before we move on?
I did promise some kind of how to approach this thing. So rapid fire, diverse knowledge. You just need to make sure that everybody understands that they're part of the team. Not everybody is Nikola Jokic. Some people are Zeke Nagy, and that's a Denver Nuggets reference for anyone who doesn't follow sports. Everybody has a job to do. Some people, like the engineering organization, has more to do.
Some people like the HR or finance or the reception has less to do, but everybody has a job to do. And as long as you communicate that, everybody's on the winning team. Resistant to change. I think Daniel brought it up. I do like the idea of a carrot and a stick. So the stick is what Daniel spoke about, threatening people or chasing them. The carrot is that we are now in an environment where everybody has a computer at home and in their pockets and at the office. So it's easier to try to convince someone to, let's say, do multi-factor authentication and strong passwords when you can also give them the message that the same can apply to your personal Instagram, Facebook, whatever you use, and that will keep you more secure. So now people are a bit more invested compared to 15 years ago where you had a computer at the office, but then you went home and you just watched TV. Maybe you didn't, you know, participate in social media and whatnot. Insufficient resources and management, buying, they go together. Daniel addressed no point in going there. Compliance, complexity in terms of requirements. I think the idea there again is to, one, try to homogenize if possible. Like look at all the standards that you need to adhere to and maybe devise something that approaches everything. And then again, go back to the idea of everybody's part of the winning team and then make reasonable requests to engineering versus finance versus HR versus office management. And for shadow IT, I think it falls a bit under the resistance to change. We need to be a bit more, what's the expression, put water in our wine, so we shouldn't be crazy strict, but also we need people to move a bit towards us and not go and open up accounts in every random SaaS out there. We should have a good onboarding process that is easy for people to get it done legit, and they should be willing to take like one day of delay and come to our process versus getting the services. So that would be the way that I try to approach things. I'm not going to claim that it works 100% all the time, but it's a good start if you manage to address this point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just can add on to that, because when you talked about opening accounts everywhere, I mean, shadow IT is definitely one risk. And what I think there is that you also, as a company, you have to be aware of how people use. You talked about people using IT in their free time and spare time. And I mean, people are much more up to date now and they use good quality services in their personal lives. So if you use all these services and then you come to your job and you say, well, here's your green screen, I mean, I use the software, I mean, people are not going to be happy with that. So in order to keep sort of people, stop people from using shadow IT, you have to provide good and modern service, secure, good and modern services to them, because otherwise they are going to be creative and find other ways, and they're going to download these things, and they're going to set up these accounts, because, I mean, that's how they work normally with IT, so. I think that's important as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the biggest example we see is the last few months with people being very on board OpenAI and ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People will seamlessly start using that at the office environment without putting too much thought. And then you need to discuss like what is the difference between using it to play at home versus uploading data, company data, and to get out the report and so on. So the lines have blurred a lot. For me, they have blurred even more because I have been working strictly remotely the past few years. So I'm looking at the same screen, either I'm doing fun stuff or work stuff. So it's very difficult sometimes to switch the mindset. Oh, maybe I shouldn't push this button in the work context. But I don't think anybody, like I start from the place where I don't believe any employee wants to be a problem intentionally. So if you give them good instructions, if you explain to them the problem, and if you frame it in a way that also benefits them in their personal life, I'm sure most of the times they will do the right thing.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, we'll move on to Andrew, your question next. And you asked, what are key ingredients cultivating a security culture? Motive, opportunity, and means. If one is missing, security culture will not achieve its full potential. So tell us more about your question.
Yeah, so to give you a little bit more of a clue of what these three ingredients are, the original version of this question read more like this: what is in common between murder and making a transformation, a security transformation in an industry? And so I'm sure you have heard it from some detective's TV show or something. You need the motive, you need the opportunity, and you need the means to be able to do it. And same thing applies for making security culture transformations. So the motive is basically that part of where we all align on where we're going with this. What kind of state do we want to create in terms of information security for the company? And that is something that everybody contributes to. And as Dimitrios was saying, like in general, most people want to do good. I don't think anybody intentionally is out there to sink us, because at the end of the day, we're all on the same boat. And culture goes to a great extent in actually creating that feeling that we all are in this together. The other part, Dimitrios also touched quite a bit on the first question, which is basically having the opportunity to actually make such changes. So imagine if you were, well, you don't really need to imagine, because I'm sure you have faced this, pretty much all of you. When we are producing software, there's pressure to produce features. And then that needs to be balanced against, like, how do we fulfill non-functional requirements related to security? And of course, I mean, non-functional requirements are not necessarily making us any money, and the features are. And so it is that, like, well, how can a developer produce safer software if you don't really give them the chance to actually do it? So that's a typical example come across. And then finally, the third thing, the means. So, I mean, if we don't give our organization the right tools to be able to actually realize this change, if we're not funding it properly, back to the first question, if we don't have buy-in from upper management and they're not investing in tools and prioritizing the investment in security tooling, then it won't happen, because you cannot do a vulnerability scan by hand, for example. You cannot work on cloud security posture management manually. It's just not going to happen. If we are not investing in these technologies or giving the means to do it, whether it be in times and financial support, in cultural support, these changes will not happen. And that is why I kind of ask this question and try to point out these three factors.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I can fill in on sort of the means, and so there's a sort of a classic example that is years ago. I mean, they always used to be this the requirement in the security policy that you have to encrypt email. Yeah, fine, good. And then usually you didn't have the tools for it, because they weren't that good tools that were available and easy to use, etc. So very often you would find that you could read the policy and it says you have to encrypt email, and then you would ask, well, how do I actually encrypt emails? And then you get a vague response. Yeah, we're working on that. There will be a solution. But I mean, how do you even motivate people to follow sort of requirements when there aren't any tools to do that? And I think there are more examples of that as well. I think these days there are more tools available. I mean, it's easier to streamline this and make it usable, etc. But that doesn't mean that you automatically have it in place, though, because, I mean, obviously you have to. So to not create a divide between what you actually, the requirements and the policy towards the users, and what they can actually sort of do, and so it should be easy to follow it, and it shouldn't come with any additional work for the user to follow the rules and requirements, because then it's not going to be used, etc. in that way.
Yeah, I also have a comment on the means. So I'm going to give an example. So a few years back, like 2-3 years, I was presenting at a conference, and we were discussing what can we do about social engineering, phishing, these type of things. So I started polling the audience, and I asked, okay, when you get an email and you look at it, do you understand what you're saying? So pretty much the vast majority of people raised their hands, and that was great. And then I opened the email, then I started looking at the headers, and I asked people, how many are you still with me? How many understand what you see here on the headers? And then a lot of the hands went down, and then finally I opened the same message in a mobile phone, and I said, okay, so how are we going to investigate the headers on the mobile phone? And
nobody knew, and that's reasonable because you can't really do it on a mobile phone. So going to what you said, Daniel, about the policy of encrypting emails and all these kind of crazy things, we kind of need to keep in mind that we might have a use case in our head as security people. So I typically read all my emails on a desktop client. I have view header capabilities. I can explode URLs in a sandbox and see what happens. But I'm very certain that my CEO reads the emails on his phone, and maybe he doesn't even have emails set up on his computer. So if I go out and say, you need to inspect the headers before opening a PDF, that is not going to fly with a lot of people. So that takes me back to the means. And the means for me is to provide as much technical controls as possible to take the decisions out of the user hands. So can my email provider stop 95% of the message? I'm going to enable all the controls possible to take this 95% away from the user and leave them with the 5% where hopefully their training will kick in, or if not that, hopefully they will reach out to me and say, hey, I received this, it looks dodgy, help me figure it out. The same with other tools that Andrew mentioned. It's very easy to tell people, don't do misconfigurations on AWS. How do we know that we haven't done any? We need tooling to make sure that something checks our work, and we shouldn't rely on an annual pen test because we make changes every day. What will the annual pen test show? So means is very important to me, and I'm certain that technology isn't there to provide 100% coverage, but if I can get 90, 85% out of the technology, I really want that. So then I can only focus the rest 15% on behavior and how we work with things and hopefully make things better by taking away the bulk of the low-hanging fruit. So that was my comment on the means.
I wanted to add a comment since you've been now following the trend about the emails. So I'll give you examples using emails. When you're trying to change a security culture, you're going to get some pushbacks. And it is, I think it is really important to remember that there is a little bit of a survivor bias kind of in how the feedback happens. So when you implement email security, or emails get quarantined and so on, and there's one person who clicks on it and they don't get their emails released right away. So they're gonna come up and basically say, oh, my email got locked, it's been there for 14 days and whatever. And that's often what you mainly hear about, right? One person got their emails locked, and that kind of tints the entire program. And that's what you kind of have to keep in mind, that what about all those 50 other cases where it worked? What about those 100 other cases that it prevented us from getting some toxic emails or getting ransomware? And so I think it is really important to bring up to the organization that there is a bit of a survivor bias effect going on here, that those who don't like it will, be the noisiest, make the most noise about the negative effects of it. And that may actually taint your whole program. So it's really important to remember that, especially dealing with upper management.
Exactly. So one thing I thought of when you said that was about you, that you said that we only hear sort of those who complain, and I think I like to link that to what we said before, that sometimes you have to scare people and you have to use sort of scary tactics, but it's also important to sort of give good examples. I mean, show good examples of when things work and when things work. So you can show statistics or how you want to show it, but I think it's also good to, for building culture, it's also good to give some reinforcements on things that have worked and things that we are good at and things that we are doing well. So finding the right balance between scaring people sometimes, but then also being good at showing progress and showing, I mean, how we are improving and give good examples as well.
I think it's becoming slightly easier because now our colleagues, all of them, they will have probably 10 plus accounts on different services, and they start to see a lot of notifications in their private accounts as well. For example, someone requested a password reset for your Apple account, and they go like, oh, wait, what is this? Are they trying to phish me or push me into doing something? So I think as technology became more available to people to use at home, they start to bring that mindset into the corporation as well. Because in the beginning, when I started working back in the 90s, like nobody had any understanding. When we were talking about internet security within the company, nobody really understood what the problem might be. Now, when they are attacked on their personal phones, emails, someone might have close friends or family that were actually attacked and had to fight a lot to get their accounts back. It makes more sense to them why we're pushing a bit more on the corporate side, because they understand they have seen the impact on a personal level, and now it makes it tangible for them.
Yeah, I agree. I see the same thing. And what I found as well is that it's good to sometimes help people with challenges from their personal lives as well. Because if they come, they will come to me. I mean, yes, Daniel, you're the security person. I saw this or this happened. You know, can you help me, or do you know why, etc. So I think that you're building a good rapport with people that way, to not just say, well, no, that's not work related. I am busy. I have meetings here. I mean, yeah, well, maybe you do, but try to help people, and especially when they give you information. I mean, they read something about a security breach or something, and obviously you read it yourself probably a week ago, but still, I mean, yes, it's great that they come and tell you. And I mean, thanks for telling me. And then that they showed interest. It's really good to encourage that kind of interest that they're showing, because it shows that they understand, and that they are becoming more aware, I think.
Absolutely. It's not just a goodwill building exercise. It's also, like, I'm going to say, factually helpful to the company, because most people, they will access personal services from their work laptop, right? Although we do have policies that say maybe don't do that.
Yeah.
Let's not kid ourselves. I'm using my work laptop at the moment to participate in this podcast. If I get a notification from Facebook, maybe I will open it on this laptop. So if my Facebook account gets hacked and people get into it, I'm using Facebook on a corporate laptop, that might go and spill into work items. So definitely goodwill building, but also there might be an element of protecting the company by making sure that the people keep good habits with their personal services when used on a corporate device.
Absolutely. And I mean, a social engineer is not going to stop and say, well, that is personal. I'm not going to try to do anything through that service, because that's, I mean, obviously they're going to go after everything. So how people act and behave in using services in the personal life does matter, because they're still the same person and they're still potential target for social engineering, for example.
Nice. And then, Andrew, you also had another question about how many CISOs are needed to change a light bulb. Only one of the light bulbs needs to want to change. So tell us a bit more about this question.
It's a joke that I have heard from other contexts. And I thought it was really funny, because in order to get the organization to change, that is the goal. But at the same time, you need to give the organization the right directions, the motive to change. You need to give the organization the opportunity to change, and you need to support it with the means to change. And so once you have all those things, the organization needs to want to take all those three things and run with it. And that's why, like, you cannot save somebody who doesn't want to be saved. And that's really what the bottom line is, why I'm asking this question. You want to create an organization that wants to change. That's why I asked.
Yeah, it was funny. But I thought about it. But I also thought about what you mentioned earlier about developers and development organizations, because that's what I've seen. I mean, it's you know, if you ask these people, I mean, is security important? Yes, of course. Do your services need to be secure? Yes, of course. But it's when it comes to when it's a competition about time, competition about resource, etc., it does become more difficult. Because like you said, you want to build as many features into something, and you obviously, I mean, you have this deadline for the project, and the customer wants it and all of that. And so at the end of the day, I mean, you are going to have to make some tough decisions and make some tough choices. And to still at that point remember that how security, how important that is, Yeah, it does become difficult. I mean, because it doesn't matter. I mean, you agree with all of it and you think it's really important, but then it comes down to it and you have some tough decision in front of you. Yeah, what are you going to do? So there, yeah, it needs to be more, a lot of people needs to be involved in that to make sure that you get it right, even in sort of tough conditions and tough situations.
Yeah, I've read Andrew's questions, and I do agree. I was hoping that it's going to lead down to, I don't know, depends on what standard the light bulb is, and then we need the appropriate tools to change the light bulb or something like that. You need to report to the regulator before touching the bulb, but I definitely agree with the statement that if you want to help, the organization needs to want to be helped. And there's an ancient Greek expression that says something like "Sin Athena and Hira Kini," which basically means the god will help, but you also need to move your hands as well. Kind of very loosely translated.
Yeah.
I hope Greeks will not get pissed when they hear that translation. So that means that bringing a CISO in is a very good start, and the CISO can give guidance and can implement things. But if nobody else cares and wants to change, then a CISO alone won't be able to make any kind of difference.
Yeah, does it matter if we have a smart light bulb though, or if it's supported by AI? Will that help, or do we still have the same challenge then?
I don't know. I'm still think... not. Oh, go on, Andrew. Sorry.
I don't think the issue really is about technology. It's really about motivation.
Yeah, it is definitely.
I mean, you could hope for a future where your dying Philips Hue will notify a robot in your house that it's dying and the robot can go and change the bulb and you don't have to care about it. But I don't know if that's in my lifetime or maybe in my son's lifetime.
And I think, I mean, that is the bottom line with all of this as well, is that because what we all very often say when we talk about security culture and security awareness is that we cannot solve everything with technology, and we cannot solve everything with services. So no, normally, I mean, I know, so since we work with technology, all of us, that usually it's like it is the first and the second choice when try to solve a problem. It's like, what tool can I get? What technical solution can I use? But when it comes to awareness and culture, you need more. And you need people's buy-in. You need people, and like Andrew says, they need to want to change as well. If they don't want to, I mean, it's going to be very difficult. So
at the root of it, it is really all about the human factor or the human element. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? And the threat actors are more aware of this than anybody else, because this is the part where they exploit. This is why social engineering techniques work so well. How do you bypass MFA? Well, social engineering. You get somebody to believe you're somebody else, and they will hand over the secret, no matter how many MFAs you actually put in place. So I think sometimes working in security, we focus too much on technology and we forget about the human factor. And what humans have is basically culture. That's what differentiates us from most other organisms on Earth, is the culture aspect of things.
Yeah. This quote that I remember, it was this security guru who said he was actually quite skilled as a technical hacker, but he was also sort of did a lot of social engineering. So what he said is that, well, I have the skills to technically hack into an organization and get the information, but why would I even do that when I can only just ask for it and they will provide it?
That sounds like Kevin Mitnick.
Definitely Kevin Mitnick, yeah. So that question is always going to be there, and unfortunately, I think that, I mean, if there's a larger organization, if they try enough people ask the same questions, you're eventually going to get the answer. What can we do to make that harder and make that more difficult? You know?
Yeah. Perfect. So has anyone got any follow-up questions or any closing statements before we wrap up the podcast?
I would like to add that I think as security professionals, it is imperative that we understand the importance of culture in the ability to build up a secure posture. Because if we don't get it, I'm very sure that threat actors out there fully understand this concept and are fully ready to exploit it. And if we don't understand it, we're going to be at a huge disadvantage.
Nice. Well, we'll leave the podcast there. This has been another Evolution Exchange podcast. I want to take this opportunity to thank Daniel, Dimitrios and Andrew for joining us on this episode and sharing your insights. If you're listening and want to get involved in one of our upcoming podcasts, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn or via email at abby.stokes@evolution-nordics.com.